It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We all want to be happy and we all want to be successful in life, but there's no surefire path we can take, no secret formula. Or is there? Dan Lerner and his collaborator, Dr. Alan Schlechter, teach a course called The Science of Happiness at New York University. They've dug deep into psychological, behavioral, and medical research to put together basic principles of happiness and success. And their new book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life, comes out this month. And Dan Lerner is in Iowa City as part of the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be at the Iowa City Public Library tomorrow afternoon at 5 p.m. for a recording of the podcast, The Window, produced by the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa. And he is here in the studio with me now. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, I just need to start with that whole idea, the science of happiness. Some people are happy, some people are not. Is there a lot of scientific basis for it?
Fortunately, there is a lot of scientific basis. And if you go way back in history, beginning of the research into psychology, we looked at both unhappiness and happiness. And as time has gone on, things have changed. The funding's changed. When World War II hit, we lost a lot of funding on the happiness side because we really had to address the challenges of post-traumatic stress disorder, of all the soldiers coming back and the families who were suffering. And not until really the late 90s did we pick it up again. And since then, we've really had a flourishing, we've had a boom in research into what we call positive psychology and what is more simply termed as happiness or well-being or thriving.
And the book that you wrote, the course that you teach, they're focused on college students, which is a really pivotal time for a lot of people. But in reading your book, I mean, clearly these are lessons that all of us, no matter what part of life we're engaged in, can use. But why do you think it's so important at that point, 18, 19 years old, for college students?
Well, college students are a unique crew, right? So think about this. Every year, 4 million students begin their college experience. And for a lot of us, we think this is going to be the best 4 years of our life or of their life at this point.
That's right? What they've been told.
That's what we were told. And it was pretty good. I had a great college experience. Many people did. And many of the college students going in right now will as well. But when we look at the challenges to well-being, the challenges to happiness, they are plentiful. So think about it this way. We have 4 million college students coming in. A 2015 poll from Gallup showed that 90% of them feel overwhelmed on a regular basis. That same poll showed that 45% of them feel sad, have felt sad in the past year. That same poll showed that over 30% of them have dealt with work debilitating depression in the past year. So, you know, you have these students who are coming in and dealing with these issues. And why? Because, well, they're leaving everything they know. For the most part, they're leaving home. They're leaving their friends. They're leaving their support systems. They're leaving the structure they had when they were in high school. Like, when you're in high school, you know where you are pretty much every moment of the day because you go downstairs for breakfast and your parents may well have made you breakfast. There's no choice there. You know where you're going for homeroom and second period and third period. You maybe have practice after school and then you go back home and that's that. You get dropped in college. You don't know where you're eating breakfast, with whom you're eating breakfast, what you're having for breakfast. For starters,
and
everything else is wide open.
Day,
exactly,
right.
Exactly. So there's so much new immediately that it can be incredibly overwhelming.
Well, and the pressure that is put on college students today, it seems like it is just mounting every year. Not only are they told this is going to be the best time in your life, but they're told this is your key to success. This is make or break time. And if you fail at this, who knows?
Might as well give up.
Right.
It's all over. You know, it's funny. What I tell my students is that Mark Zuckerberg and Taylor Swift basically ruined your life. And don't get me wrong. I love them both. I think they're wonderful. But when I graduated from college, one of my best friends, I remember him saying, I want to make $1 million by the time I'm 30. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. I don't know if I'll ever make $1 million. But that's pretty quite an endeavor. And now the college students look around and basically think, I need to make $1 million by the time I'm 22, right? Because if I don't, then I'm a failure. Because there's so many folks out there who are young, or let me put it differently. We highlight people who are young and successful. So we isolate the Taylor Swifts and the Mark Zuckerbergs and the other folks who made
it huge. We highlight and idolize people
exactly.
who are young and successful.
Exactly. So if I can't make it to that, well, my time has passed. That is a lot of pressure.
Now, we've been talking about happiness and success, and you kind of dive deep into the relationship between happiness and success in your book. One does not necessarily lead to the other.
No, and unfortunately, it doesn't. And what we often say is that the relationship is reversed. We think when we're successful, we're going to be happy. A lot of our culture, I should say, thinks when we're successful, we're going to be happy. When I get the car I want, I'm going to be happy. When I get the house I want, when I get the salary I want, or I get the promotion, or I get the title, I'm going to be happy. But that's very rarely the case. Usually when those things happen, we're happy for a couple of days or for a week or two, and then we're not. There's even a study, we look at professors, since we're here at the university. We ask professors, not at this university, but nationwide, how happy do you think you'll be when you get tenure? And they're like, oh, it's going to be the greatest thing ever. I can't wait. It's going to be wonderful. My life is going to be completely different. And they get tenure, and things are pretty good for a couple of weeks. And a couple of months later, they're back to baseline. So we realize that it's not necessarily those things. Let's look at some examples in our culture. So the number one highest earners in our culture are attorneys. Right? They're number one for white-collar income. They're also number one for nicotine abuse. They're number one for alcohol abuse. And number one in depression. So clearly, it's not just making the money. If you look at new Wall Street hires, the highest starting incomes on Wall Street also have the highest levels of depression. So
and in our culture, we do have this idea that, okay, if I work really hard, if I just sacrifice everything right now, then my reward comes later. And you may be successful in your job, successful financially with that approach, but it does not correlate with happiness.
No, we have yet to find that it correlates with happiness at all. You know, we actually find that it's the inverse, which is that when we emphasize, when we start with happiness, we start with positive relationships and positive emotions and meaning and purpose and things that we're engaged with, we actually have a much better chance of being successful, not just defining it as successful throughout life, but being successful in our office, on the field, in the classroom. We know that students who are assessed as being more optimistic have higher grade point averages. We know that people who have higher levels of positive emotion, doctors, for example, studies we've seen when they have been primed to be happy, they diagnose symptoms more accurately. So there's something going on with our brain when we're happy, and it actually gives us an advantage.
And maybe if we're happy, happy people may be more successful, but maybe if we're happy, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Maybe that is success in and of itself.
Well, I think you just put your finger on it, which is how do you define success? And that's a question that I ask students, and you just put here, and I think we can ask everybody, how do you define success? Not how does someone else, not how do your parents define it for you, or your peers define it for you, or anyone else, but how do you define success? And not just at the office, but in your life.
Now, you were throwing out a couple of phrases here that come up a lot in your book. I mentioned earlier there is no secret formula, or maybe there is a secret formula. You actually have an acronym, and you threw out a couple of the things that are in that acronym that really do seem to correlate to our happiness, our well-being. Your acronym is PERMA.
Right.
Tell me more about it.
So I can't take credit for the acronym. That acronym is Marty Seligman's. Marty Seligman is who we call the father of positive psychology. He's been at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a mentor of mine. He's been there for almost 50 years now, I want to say. And basically, it's his construct of well-being. So let's break it down. My class is called The Science of Happiness, our class, Alan and myself. And we tell the students early on, we kind of tricked you in here. Because if this was called The Science of Well-Being, you probably wouldn't be in this course. Right? There are 475 students in there. And by the time we've gotten them in there, we're like, okay, now that we have you, we can tell you what's really up. PERMA is a construct that's much richer than just happiness, right? Happiness is a smile on your face. It's wonderful. It's joy. It's calm. It's many different positive emotions. But PERMA stands for positive emotions, engagement. The R is for relationships. The M is for meaning. And the A is for achievement or accomplishment. And so the theory goes that we need to have a drop in each of these buckets, right? If each of these letters or ideas are a bucket, we need to have something in there. They don't all have to be overflowing, but we have to have a little something. So, for example, let's say you are overflowing on accomplishment, right? Things are going really, really well for you, right? But your bucket of the R, the relationships, is empty. If you have no one to share it with, how good is it really, right? Does it limit your ability to have well-being? If you have plenty of engagement, if you're at work and you just find it fascinating and it's something that you look forward to getting to, but there's not a whole lot of positive emotion, or if there's no positive emotion in your life, it's hard to really be flourishing, thriving, or have well-being. So everyone's going to have a different matrix. Some people are going to want more relationships. Some people are going to thrive with more meaning. But everyone needs to have a drop in each bucket, and that's key. You know, what I say to the students often, and I say this to you right now, it's the cheesiest line I will say all semester. It's also the cheesiest line I will say to you, and maybe I've said in my life, but get ready. You are all beautiful little snowflakes. And they all groan. I'm like, I know, you should totally groan. It's a total groanable line. But that is to say that each of you is going to have a very different matrix of thriving. And it's really up to you in this course and in your life to figure out what works best for you. But you should be aware that if you keep these five elements in your mind throughout the semester and for the listeners throughout your day, throughout your life, if you're not having a particularly great day or otherwise, where are you falling short? Maybe you need to get back to relationships, or maybe you need to look at your emotions or your engagement or meaning, or are you accomplishing things? And it doesn't have to be a huge accomplishment. It can be, did I knock off my checklist today? If you don't have one of those in your life, that might be a reason why you're challenged.
Well, when you say positive emotion, I mean, obviously we have many different emotions. To be emotionally healthy, you have a lot of different emotions. You don't have to be happy and smiley all the time to be an emotionally healthy person. When you say positive emotions, what exactly are you meaning?
Right, that's right. And so Barb Fredrickson at University of North Carolina has the leading researcher on positive emotion, has defined positive emotion, or has offered us many, many different types of emotion. And studied, I should say, many different types of positive emotions. So for those people who see it as the big smiley face, wonderful. If it's laughter, terrific. If it's joy, some of these traditional ways of thinking about positive emotions, yes. But calm is certainly a positive emotion. Feeling peaceful is a positive emotion. When we have moments of transcendence as well, spiritual transcendence, which don't bring a smile to our face, which don't cause us to jump up and down, but to feel a real sense of deep, calm. That's positive emotion too.
And we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Dan Lerner. His new book is called You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. He's one of the instructors of a course called The Science of Happiness at New York University. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're exploring the science of happiness. Dan Lerner is here with me. He teaches a course at New York University, a very popular course called The Science of Happiness. And his new book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life, comes out this month. He's in Iowa City as part of the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be at the Iowa City Public Library tomorrow afternoon at 5 p.m. for a recording of the podcast, The Window, produced by the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa. And Dan, before the break, we were talking about some of these elements of happiness, of well-being, the positive emotions, engagement, relationships, meaning, and achievement. We're focusing a little bit on the positive emotions and how there's a whole variety of emotions that are positive. And when you were writing about that, you also shared some scientific research about how positive emotions can affect our success at a certain task. And you just mentioned a study just a couple of minutes ago, how if, for example, a doctor is primed with a positive emotion, they will actually have a higher success rate at diagnosing things properly. Tell me more about that study, because it really illustrates how powerful this can be.
Yeah. You know, there are two studies that I like to link together. That is one of them. And what happened in that study was that they took three groups of doctors. They had at least 3 years of medical experience. And they gave each group 50 symptoms to diagnose. The first group was primed in no way at all. Simply go ahead and diagnose. The second group was given a medical journal to read for 15 minutes to theoretically get their brain moving. And the third group really simply was just given a bag of candy. Right. Now, they weren't allowed to eat the candy because the sugar would have wreaked havoc on the research, on the study. But they were basically primed with positive emotion. They were made to laugh or to smile with a simple gesture. And those doctors in this study diagnosed about 20% more accurately than their non-primed and medically primed colleagues. And, you know, most listeners out there are not doctors. So how does that work for everyone else? The other study that comes to mind, which people love, because we all share this experience, was done on five-year-olds. And in this study, they took a group of five-year-olds. We have all been there, other than those listeners who are four and under. We've all been there. And they were basically given simple puzzles. Think of it like Legos. They were given some Legos, essentially, and they were given a structure to copy. Here's a picture. Build the structure. And the first group of kids was just given the Legos. Here you go. Start to build. The second group of kids was, before they were allowed to begin, were asked a simple question. We want you to think of the happiest memory you can for the next 30 seconds. Now, they're five, right? So what could the happiest memory possibly have been? It couldn't have been like I met my life partner,
right?
You know, from across the room
in
a sandbox.
I had a great birthday party, or I love cupcakes.
Exactly. I had a cupcake today. Kickball was awesome. I got the gold crayon that no one ever gets, right? They were super simple. But what ended up happening was that those kids who were primed with positive emotion performed about 50% more accurately. They were more collaborative. They were even quicker in building this structure and following this game. So whether you're a doctor or a five-year-old or anything in between or beyond, it seems like when we prime our brains with positive emotions, our brains operate differently.
So that's something that all of us could implement immediately. If you think about getting ready for a test, so many students are so focused on cramming for the test, stressing about the test. Yeah. Just taking a couple of minutes to think about something happy might actually improve their performance on a test.
Yeah. Hey, look, if you're talking about a test, if you have a ball game coming up or you have some competition coming up, if you have a musical performance coming up and you're nervous, and if you are beyond college and you have a meeting coming up that you're stressed out about, you have a big presentation coming up, you have anything coming up that is important to you, being able to prime yourself with positive emotions can help you perform at a higher level. So take a second. Watch that cat video on YouTube. Call your best friend. Have a quick laugh. Do something that raises your spirits, and it can be really helpful to your performance.
Now, the inverse of this is how powerful negative emotions can also be. And, of course, I mean, we're all going to have bad experiences in life, and that's okay.
Of course.
But how do you control that when you're also trying to get through the day and get things done?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about challenging moments, how do we move on from those things? Part of it is how we explain challenging moments. So now we're kind of looking at optimism and pessimism, right? So if something bad happens, let's go back to the test, for example. Or if you're out there and you have a meeting today that doesn't go so well, or you had one yesterday that didn't go so well, anything that was an event that didn't go well, how are you explaining it to yourself? Are you telling yourself, well, clearly this is the way it is. I'll never pass a test in here again. And maybe I'm not smart enough to pass tests in other classes. And maybe it's not just academics, but maybe I'm not good enough for other things. That's a pretty quick spiral. That's pessimism. That's how we explain bad events for the future. But with optimism, it's not about saying it never happened. It's not about saying I struck out at the plate or I didn't do well on a test or I whiffed on the meeting. It's about saying that was one meeting. And I have another one coming up, and doesn't mean it's going to happen again, right? It's about saying there are things I can do to do better next time for the test. Maybe I have to study harder. Maybe it's something like this was a really particularly challenging test, and so the next one is not necessarily going to be this hard. And it's not like my doing poorly on one test is going to affect how I do in other classes that I take, in other meetings that I have, in other areas of my life. So how we explain bad events goes a long way towards how we move forward.
Now, I am an optimist. I've always been an optimist my whole life. And there's been a lot of debate about optimism and pessimism and whether this is just a state. If you are an optimist, you're always an optimist. If you're a pessimist, you're always a pessimist. So can we train ourselves to be optimists and harness the power of optimism?
Well, I think you make a very good point, and beginning with the idea that you've always been an optimist, because people tend to be wired to lean one way or the other. I've been an optimist for a long time, too. But first of all, it's not always great to be an optimist. If you ask anyone who got on the Titanic and was sure it was never going to sink, you know that it's not always the way to go. And if you look at college students who are overly optimistic about how they're going to do, they tend to actually do more poorly in college because they think, oh, I'm going to do great. I don't have to study. I can go out all the time. I can do whatever I need. I'm going to pass with flying colors. Well, that's a little bit too much, right? But when we see – then there's a style of pessimism, defensive pessimism, that says, you know what? Maybe I should study more because I might not do so well on the test. It's the same people who say, I should probably get that flu shot because there is a chance I'm going to get the flu. But for those people, while they may do well on tests, they tend to not be happy as happy in their lives. They have lower levels of positive emotion, and they don't enjoy their victories as much. So it's a real trade-off. But when it comes to whether you can become one or the other, the argument and the studies, the science really over the past 25 years, and back to Seligman, says that you can. His book, Learned Optimism, was groundbreaking. He had originally done studies on how people become depressed, and he had found that people basically learn to be depressed. When they're taught there's nothing they can do to change their mood, to change their state, then they give up and they stop trying, and that's a very rapid downward spiral. And he flipped the research on its head and looked at optimism to find that, yes, when we realize that we can create change in our life, there are actions we can take to raise our levels of positive emotion or to move on to the next opportunity and make the most of it rather than giving up, then we can begin to have that more frequently in our life. And so when we start to take action, in a way we're reprogramming our brain to be able to look towards the possibilities rather than look to the things we can't do. And that's become routine. And thus we develop greater levels of optimism.
I can imagine some people listening to that right now and starting to hear some alarm bells because, chemical depression is a real thing. Mental illness is a real thing. And I know so many people who have struggled with depression and their friends are like, couldn't you just try harder to learn to be happier? And of course, it just doesn't work.
No. And thanks for bringing that up. And it's incredibly important to know that there are some issues that we face with mental illness that really require professional help. And once we get it, it's absolutely treatable. Can we do it ourselves? No. In many cases, no. It requires visits to a therapist. In some cases, it requires medication. So we have that, fortunately, in our healthcare system. We have wonderful therapists out there who can help us with that.
And you dedicate a chapter of the book to that as well, because that's something that a lot of college students, which is your target audience, have a hard time realizing when they need help with something like that.
That's right. And given the numbers, especially how many students, I used the number before, more than 30% of college students face work debilitating depression during their time in school. That's a national average. But if we look at other schools, there's one school which will remain unnamed. It's a prestigious school in the Northeast, rhymes with Schmarbert. And that school, one study showed that 80% of their students faced work debilitating depression.
Wow. So
that's it's an incredibly high number. And given the pressures and stresses that college students are facing on an increasing basis, we mentioned before, we're seeing more issues with mental illness. And particularly depression, anxiety-related challenges. So being able to feel comfortable going to a wellness center on campus is essential to their really being able to thrive at school. One of the things that we do in our course, the very first day, is we have people raise their hands with a simple question, like who here has felt overwhelmed during their time in college? And most of the hands go up. Who here has felt anxious during their time in college? Many, vast majority of the hands go up. It's not because we want to know. It's because we want the students to raise their hands and look around and go, whoa.
It's not just me.
I'm not alone. It's not just me. So I shouldn't feel like I'm the only person on campus going to address issues with potential depression, anxiety, and stress. There are others out there like me. And I find when that happens, and hopefully for folks who are listening in college, to know that it's actually begun to be a mark of pride. I've had students come up in front of lots of other students and say, I finally went to see a therapist. It was so cool. Like, this has really been helpful for me. And so I hope that people start to take that on, understand that it's actually something that helps them, that they shouldn't be anything other than proud of to be addressing their well-being.
I'm talking with Dan Lerner. He is one of the co-authors of the new book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. He's also one of the teachers of a course called The Science of Happiness at New York University. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your experiences at 866-780-9100. You can also email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Dan, we talked a little bit about optimism versus pessimism, and want to talk more about some of the things that we can do to really change our level of happiness, possibly impact our success as well. But before we get to that, I want to talk about something else that seems to divide people into two separate groups, and that's the growth mindset versus the fixed mindset. Tell me more about that.
So growth mindset and fixed mindset has been studied, pioneered really by a woman named Carol Dweck at Stanford. Berkeley, I'm sorry, for the past number of decades. And the basic idea behind the two mindsets are, do I believe that if I work hard, I can improve at something? Or do I believe that my level of skill essentially remains fixed for the rest of my life? And that's a huge component to how we grow, how we change in our lives. So, for example, if I have a student in the course who says, yeah, you know, I suck at math, always have, always will. Right, then the way that they pursue anything in that field is completely different from somebody else. But when we give you an example of a study, we looked at fifth graders who were read two different styles of biographies. The first group were read Edison and Einstein and Helen Keller. And the biographies basically said these three people have been amazing ever since they were born. Right, they were brilliant. They were incredibly gritty and had a great work ethic ever since they were born. Then you read the same people to another group of fifth graders. But this time it's Thomas Edison worked incredibly hard. He grew. He changed. Like Albert Einstein failed when he was young, and he picked himself back up. Helen Keller was incredibly frustrated, and she kept endeavoring to make herself better, and she grew and grew and grew. Then you ask those fifth graders afterwards if they'd like a tutor for a course that they're being challenged, they find particularly challenging. The fifth graders who've been read the stories of they were always brilliant, they didn't have to work hard, most of them will say no. About 80% of them will say no. But then you look at the other group, and about 80% of them will say yes. So it's the idea of how do we explain to our kids and to ourselves that we can change when we put forward the effort, right? And that makes a big difference. So it is literally a mindset of how we grow, or rather, if we grow.
We all have our own strengths, and of course, identifying those strengths will help us decide what we want to do with our lives. You have another secret formula, a way to identify strengths. How do you do it?
Right. It's not so secret anymore. Thank you very much, Charity. So there have been a number of ways to look at strengths that have been strongly studied for the past 20 years or so. Some folks might be familiar with StrengthsFinder. It's a very popular strengths assessment out there done by the Gallup organization. The one that we work with in our course is called VIA. It stands for Values in Action. And they both assess what our strengths are. Values in Action are really about those values that we hold most close to our hearts, the values with which we thrive, the values when we put into action that we feel like, and this is what people will say, I feel like my true self. I feel like the real me. So first of all, take the assessment. Go to the VIA website, VIA, I believe it's viainstitute.org, but if you just Google VIA Institute, there's a free assessment. And you'll find that you have these signature strengths. They're usually the top 3 to 5 strengths that you have in your assessment. When we use those on a regular basis, we tend to be much more engaged in our work, much more engaged in our life. We tend to have much higher levels of positive emotion. We nurture much more healthy relationships. It's a pathway to finding greater meaning, so on and so forth. So I'll give you an example. The Gallup organization polled employees at various companies and found that those companies that encourage their employees to use their strengths on a regular basis, those employees have about a 78% chance of being engaged at work, meaning like deeply into it, looking forward to it, like just sort of fascinated by it, losing track of time, getting into flow kind of thing. But the employees where their employers push them to shore up their weaknesses, push them to attack those weaknesses and really raise them up a level, rather than emphasizing strengths, those employees had about a 9% chance of being engaged at work. 91% chance of not being engaged on a day-to-day basis. So if I can give you an example, something like bravery. If bravery shows up as a strength, it might be for a student really raising your hand when you know it's a challenging question in front of a big class. It might be getting involved in social and civic movements that really require that you get out there, you stand out, because when they do, they're going to feel more engaged. They're going to feel better. They're going to be able to be their authentic self, so to speak. So when you get the assessment, have a look at what your strengths are. Talk to your friends. Talk to your parents. Talk to your teachers. Show them the report and ask them, when does this show up for me? Because you might find it happens more often than you realize.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Dan Lerner. He's one of the co-authors of the new book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. It harnesses the science of happiness. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Dan Lerner. He's one of the co-authors of the new book, You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. He teaches a course called The Science of Happiness at New York University, and he's in Iowa. He's in Iowa City right now for the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be at the Iowa City Public Library tomorrow afternoon at 5 p.m. for a recording of the podcast, The Window, produced by the Bell and Blank Center at the University of Iowa. And Dan, we've been talking a lot about different kinds of mindsets, ways that we can change our thinking that may increase our happiness and therefore increase our success, our performance at different things. We have an email from someone and asking a question that I think a lot of people ask. It says, explain to me a way to see expecting good things to happen as rational. To me, it's delusional. I know it would help me if I could.
Right. So that's a great question. You know, in between, the other principle we didn't talk about is reality. And getting a sense of reality can be really challenging because what you see as a dirty house, someone else might not see as a dirty house. What you see as an opportunity, what someone else sees as an opportunity, you might see as delusional. So getting feedback is incredibly important. What we talk a lot about in our course, and we certainly do in this book, is the idea of realistic optimism. Because you're right, it can be delusional if you go too far. If you stand on the edge of the Grand Canyon and say, I'm going to jump over it now, I know I can. Clearly that's delusional. And if you get feedback from someone, they'll tell you the same thing. But if you're talking about applying to a school or applying for a certain job, and thinking, I think I can get that job at a really sought-after place. Let's say it's a Google, a place where a lot of people want to work. Getting feedback on that from mentors, from peers, about how possible that is can be really helpful. Let's say you've applied to the same job 3 times and you haven't gotten in. Well, is it because you're blindly going back every time and not changing anything? Or are you getting feedback to say, hey, what can I do differently next time? Are you taking an action to help yourself achieve whatever it is you're trying to achieve? The idea of sitting back and thinking, oh yeah, I'll be a Major League Baseball player because, you know, I want to be, is very different from understanding what it is that I have to do and then thinking, I'm actually doing everything I possibly can here. I'm taking as much action as I can. I'm optimistic that if I do so, based on the feedback I've gotten from people, I have a shot. But some people might say, look, you're 5'1". You know, no baseball player has ever been that short, and I love your optimism. It's not going to work. So getting a reality check is essential when you're really pushing.
Well, and you write a lot about how when you do get feedback from people, the kind of feedback you get is important, too, because if you're just getting negative feedback, someone who tells you all the things that you're doing wrong, that's not going to help you grow
right,
either. So you also have to get feedback about your strengths and about the things that you're doing right. So you may need to choose who you get your feedback from.
That's right.
And that doesn't mean you want them to lie to you.
No, not at all. I mean, criticism is incredibly important. Don't get me wrong. For that email, negative emotions are important. Pessimism is important at the right time, right? If you're all optimistic, you never look both ways when you cross the street. You're going to get hit by a bus, right? If you're always pessimistic, you're never going to leave the house, right? So being able to get an array of folks who can give you critical feedback, what it is you need to fix, but also positive feedback. Those things that are going well are really essential. One of the things we've done in our course for the last 5 years is we'll keep notes throughout because we teach together on those things that we need to fix and those things that went well. We have our TAs. We have 10 teaching assistants. We want the feedback. What would you fix and what went well? Because we know not everything is wonderful. Even if we're optimistic about it, we know there are opportunities to change and grow. And that's how we stay grounded.
Now, I really enjoyed some of your insight into little ways that we can change our lives that may increase our happiness in big ways.
Yeah.
One of those, you talk about practicing gratitude, which we've talked about a lot on this program. That can be something that can really have an impact in your outlook for the day. But another one is about minimizing decision making. We apparently have way too much choice to be happy. Is that?
Well, you know, one of the things I should say about this book is, in a lot of ways, it's an amalgam of many of my mentors and wonderful ideas that go on in positive psychology. This one really comes from Barry Schwartz, who wrote a wonderful book called The Paradox of Choice, which I highly recommend. Check out his TED Talk. But he, among others, have talked about this challenge of choice, right? We live in a culture where we think the more choice, the better, right? The more opportunity we have to pick whatever's right for us, the happier we're going to be. But Sheena Iyengar out at Columbia University and a colleague looked at, very, very simply, took jam to the masses. They went to a grocery store and they set up two tables, rotating each day. The first day, they set out six different kinds of jam. People are welcome to have free tastes. And then if they want to buy, they can. The second day, they put out 24 different kinds of jam. Same thing. You're welcome to taste. If you want to buy, fantastic. The results were really interesting. People tasted on average about 1.5 taste of jam. But the people who came to the sixth jam table, they bought about 30% of them bought jam. The people who came to the 24 choice table, only 3% of them bought jam because they got so overwhelmed by the possibility, by what am I going to buy, that they became paralyzed by even the idea of even buying anything. So when we think about, we once had one kind of breakfast cereal. You and I are wearing headphones right now. There was a time when there was one kind of headphone out there, and it sucked. It was black, and it scratched your head. It didn't sound very good, but you were like, yay, I have tunes in my ears. This is fantastic. And then you got a second pair, and they were not black. They were silver. And you were like, wait, what am I going to get? The fact you had to choose means you're leaving one on the table.
Right, now there's 50.
Forget about it.
Right.
Exactly. There are hundreds of just beats, right? So once you buy one, the other 400 – you're leaving behind, and you think about those things. That's a real challenge. So how can we minimize our choices? Sometimes it's by creating like a filter. Basically, if you go online and you're going to buy something for all your students, you're going to buy a backpack. You go on there are 1,000 backpacks. Check the box of what you want to pay. You've just cut it down by 50%. It's $50 or less. Then check the color you want. I want black. You just cut it down by another 75%. So you just minimize your choices, and you're not looking at all these things thinking, oh, if I would have spent $51, maybe I could have gotten that one. And you end up being far happier with your choice, we're finding, than if you have too many choices. And I just say this as a final, which is we looked at people, college graduates who are looking at jobs. People who look at jobs and look at all the options, called the maximizers. They want the best pay. They want the best location. They want the best place. They want the best opportunity. They end up making about $7,000 more on average than the people who basically say, These are the attributes I want. I want to work with people I like. I want to make just enough money to be able to be okay, so on and so forth. So the others made $7,000 more, but the ones who limited their choices reported being far more fulfilled in the work that they did and the lives that they lived. And that was huge.
Now, we're going to run out of time, I know. So let's kind of cruise through a couple of things. Self-care is incredibly important, and everybody has heard that over and over again. You've got the science to back it up. You need to exercise, you need to eat well, and you need to get sleep. These are things college students are often very short on.
Absolutely. Absolutely true. And look, and this is the thing. We don't want to be prescriptive. We want to be descriptive. We don't want to tell you what to do. We just want to tell you what happens if you decide to do it. So when for all the college students listening out there, I'm not going to tell you to get a solid 8 hours because the majority of you won't, and you probably turn the radio off right now if I did. So what does happen when you get a certain amount of sleep, though? What does your memory – what are you able to retain? And it's pretty extraordinary what you're able to retain when you get ample sleep. Now, for some of you, you can do fine on 6 hours. Some can do fine on 7. Some can do fine on 8. So what are some tips and tricks? Take a nap. I know it sounds like – I sound like your grandfather right now, right? You got to take a nap. You feel better. But when we look at studies of people who nap, if you are taught something – and this is, I'm taking this from various studies. If you are taught something, let's say you're given a math problem, and then you're allowed to take a 10 to 15-minute nap, you are far more likely to wake up and be able to perform that problem at a much higher level than those people who did not take that 10 to 15-minute nap. When we take that nap, our brains start to do things that they can't do when we're awake. So we end up functioning on a much higher level. We look at exercise. We look at a school in Illinois, Naperville High. When they instituted a different kind of exercise, rather than just going to the gym, they were graded on how consistently they kept their heart rates up in a certain area. That school took a jump from 16 in the world to number one in the world in math and number three in the world in science. So we know that when people exercise, we're feeding our brains something called BDNF, which is basically like Miracle-Gro for the brain. This is work done by John Rady at Harvard. So we find that when we exercise, we grow our neurons. Our neural pathways are healthier. They're richer. We retain more information. We make connections more easily. And look, for all you college students and everyone out there, we look at studies that show that when you have something for breakfast, anything for breakfast, like Pop-Tarts, couch pizza, like whatever it is you put in your bellies, not that I'm recommending you eat those things, but eating anything, those people who do perform better on their tests later on that morning. So knowing that you can just shove something in your mouth on your way to school, take a little nap, shut your eyes for a little while, or just walk up and down the stairs of the library for 5 minutes every hour can help. That can be nice little shortcuts to improve performance.
One of the difficult things at this time of life, and we revisit it, you know, many of us later on in our life, is trying to decide what it is that we want to do with our lives. And I mean, it's one thing to say I want to succeed at what I've chosen to do, but it's another thing entirely to figure out what that thing is and what will actually make you happy. So finding meaning in your work, in your life, is such a difficult challenge for so many people. What's your advice?
You know, I tell you what, I'm going to, if I may, switch gears and go from meaning to passion, only because we do have a little time. Meaning is a big question. And passion is, there's such rich science right now in passion. And the passion that we choose can lead to meaning. When students at the University of Montreal were polled, 535 students were polled, who here believes that finding a passion is part of a fulfilling life? 100% of them raised their hands. The question is how, right? And a passion is defined as something that you have a strong urge to do on a regular basis and that you do about 8.5 hours a week. So that can be anything from gardening to cooking to cycling to reading to being with friends. It can be a whole array of different things. Now, here's the thing, is that there are two different ways to explore passion. One is really unhealthy. It's called obsessive passion. It's something you pursue because your parents want you to pursue it or because the social status or the money it brings you, so on and so forth. But the other way is harmonious passion. That's intrinsically driven. It's the idea of, what do you want to do when you get up in the morning? What are you looking forward to doing? Are you looking forward to going to pre-med class because your folks want you to be a doctor or because you think it's a safe route? Or are you looking forward to going to pre-med class because you're fascinated by the cardiovascular system, because you're fascinated by the way the body works, because you're fascinated by the idea of helping people physically? If it's intrinsically motivated, the odds of our developing positive relationships, the odds of our having greater levels of positive emotion, the odds of our gaining in meaning, you know, we've seen the studies where harmonious passion leads to greater meaning is much, much greater. So pursuing those things that are really important to us, that we find to be things that we're compelled to do, makes a big difference. We can be obsessively passionate, and a lot of people are. I would take Steve Jobs as obsessively passionate. I would take Kanye West potentially as obsessively passionate. I would take number of musicians, that's sort of the famous ones, or even a writer like Hemingway as obsessively passionate. It doesn't necessarily mean Bob Knight, you know, for basketball fans out there, obsessively passionate. But you look at what happened to their lives. You can become great through obsessive passion, but it doesn't lead to happiness. When we look at harmonious passion, the Ellen DeGeneres's of the world, the Richard Bransons of the world, the Maya Angelous of the world, we look at those folks, and when we look at students, the studies of students who are harmoniously passionate, they are happier in their lives, and they are equally successful to the people who've been obsessive. So I'd say if you're really looking to pursue a wonderful life that's both successful on field and off, on stage and off, in the classroom in a way, in the boardroom in a way, in the surgical room in a way, in any work that you do and in your life, look at the idea of passion. And that just starts with doing something that you're interested in. Take one
class.
Does
it have to be work?
No, it doesn't. And that's a great question. We find that folks who who are not passionate about work but have harmonious passions away from work are happier at work. Right. So they know that they love gardening. They do it on a regular basis. They love cooking. They do it on a regular basis.
But that doesn't mean they work in a restaurant or
exactly right
farm.
Exactly right. It means that they know they have balance in their life because if they're making time to garden, cycle, play tennis, be with friends, read a book, It means they're not so obsessive about their work that they're staying there for all hours. So, and it tends to bleed over because they enjoy their life. They're happier people to work with, so they nurture better relationships at work. They have a life that they enjoy that is really fulfilling, and it's not centered on one thing that is just work. And that really ends up driving often fulfilling, thriving lives.
You share some very powerful moments with students who realize that they're on the wrong path, that they're pursuing something for the wrong reasons, or maybe they're burnt out on it, which is something, of course, we can experience many times in life. Is that part of the key to being able to recognize, okay, this is what I've always thought that I wanted, but maybe now it's not?
You know, one of my favorite books in the literature is a book called Stumbling on Happiness. It's by Dan Gilbert. Again, he's based at Harvard. Hilarious guy, great writer, great TED talker. And what Gilbert says is that we are human beings are particularly bad at predicting the future, right? And part of that is because what we want when we're 18, when we're 18, we say by the time I'm 20, I want to be CEO. We don't know what it is to be a CEO, A. And B, we don't know who we are when we're 28. So if we put our head down and go, I'm just going for CEO for the next 10 years and don't stop to assess, well, am I enjoying what I'm doing? Am I engaged by what I'm doing on a regular basis? If we don't talk to that CEO and say, what's your life really like? And realize that maybe it's not what we expect it to be, then we're setting ourselves up to fail. You made a point before, we drive to be successful. If I just work through it, I'll be happy. Some of the most unhappy people in our culture are attorneys, are lawyers. And what a lot of them do is say, and we look at studies out of Florida State, say, you know, basically they say, if I just work as hard as I possibly can, I know it's going to really be tough and it's going to stink for the next 3 years of law school and then 5 years of associateness until I really make it. They never bother to pick their head up and say, am I really enjoying this? Am I engaged by what I do on a day-to-day basis? And they get there and it's really hard to turn around and do anything else at that point. So having students who come up and say, yeah, I'm pre-law or pre-med or pre-anything, I'm studying anything, I'm not really enjoying it. You know, not everything is fun, but if you're not looking forward to it, if you're not engaged by it, at least on a somewhat regular basis, if you don't see how it works into your life in a healthy way that you're eager to pursue, that's a great sign that maybe you're on the wrong path. Not that you have to switch paths entirely, but maybe research in psychology isn't your thing. Maybe it's being a clinician. Maybe, you know, baseball doesn't have to be a pro. Maybe it's just having sports in your life. Maybe it's just a slight shift that can make all the difference.
Dan Lerner, thank you so much.
So, thank you for having me.
Dan Lerner teaches a course at New York University called The Science of Happiness. He and his collaborator, Dr. Alan Schlechter, have written a new book called You Thrive, How to Succeed in College and Life. It comes out later this month. And Dan Lerner is in Iowa City as part of the Mission Creek Festival. He'll be at the Iowa City Public Library tomorrow afternoon at 5 p.m. for a recording of the podcast, The Window. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.